Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Sam, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, highlights from the 2014 American Society of Clinical Oncology, or ASCO, annual meeting. Now, today's program is part two of a two-part series, and it's a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration that we have so many of you on the call today. We have over 1,545 participants on the call today, and you come from all of the United States. And we also have international participants from Austria, Canada, Ireland, the Netherlands, New Zealand, and United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world. And it's a credit to you that you've chosen to spend this next, hour and a half with us on this call today. Now, today's activity was made possible by Genentech, a member of the Roche Group, Lilly, contribution from Lilly, we appreciate that, also Novartis Oncology, Millennium, the Takeda Oncology Company, and an educational donation provided by Amgen. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing them. Our first speaker today is Dr. Al Benson. Dr. Benson is Professor of Medicine, Associate Director for Clinical Investigations, Robert H. Lurie Comprehensive Cancer Center of Northwestern University. And Dr. Benson is going to address clinical trials and evidence-based care. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Benson.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and thanks to the audience for giving me this opportunity to talk briefly about cancer clinical trials and evidence-based medicine. These are very exciting times in cancer medicine. For example, over the last 2 years, over 30 new cancer drugs have been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. And these approvals have been possible because of the extensive clinical trials research that has been done in the United States and around the world. Just briefly, clinical trials are part of a very careful research process, and they're designed to find better ways to prevent, diagnose, and treat cancer. Most clinical trials are evaluating new drugs or procedures, but some evaluate drugs or procedures that have actually already been approved by the FDA, but they're being given, for example, in new ways for different diseases or in different combinations. Now, the type of clinical trials we do in cancer medicine are not just specific for cancer drugs and procedures and devices, but also we have studied a variety of other aspects of prevention, for example. There have been clinical trials looking at aspirin, at dietary patterns, the use of vitamins such as vitamin D. And actually, some of these concepts of prevention are actually now being incorporated into cancer treatment trials, including the use of agents such as vitamins and aspirin. We also look at critical factors such as quality of life for patients receiving treatment. There have been supportive drugs that have been approved in clinical trials. So, for example, great advances in controlling nausea secondary to cancer treatment has come from the development of anti-nausea drugs in clinical trials. We also look at trials evaluating pain medicines, how best to control pain, as well as conducting clinical trials using surgical techniques and radiation. These trials are funded by a variety of resources. They include the National Cancer Institute, private industry, and even individual cancer centers and other research institutions and hospitals that provide a great deal of research support to conduct these trials. And these trials in the United States are not only conducted at academic medical centers and large cancer centers, they're actually conducted extensively by community hospitals and oncology practices. All disciplines in medicine conduct clinical trials. However, cancer medicine stands out because clinical trial participation by our patients is integrated in the care we provide patients every single day. And often, a clinical trial may be the very best option for an individual patient at a moment in time. We need to stress that all cancer therapies have been developed by this clinical trials process, and it's been by the active participation by our patients and our physician, nurses, and other research personnel that have made this possible. Now, the type of trials vary tremendously. The largest type of clinical trials, referred to as phase three trials, are usually looking at newer treatment approaches and comparing those approaches to what might be called a very standard cancer therapy. And by doing this type of very advanced trial, which often involves hundreds and even thousands of patients who participate, we really get much better understanding if a new approach is superior to a standard care approach, or if it offers the same results for a patient and what exactly the toxicities may be. Earlier phase trials, such as phase one trials, are often giving brand new drugs and sometimes for the very first time to a human being. And in these type of trials, we really have to understand what the side effects are and how best to not only determine a dose for the drug, but also the schedule. For example, how often to give the drug. Phase two trials are designed to determine how well these drugs really work. And then from there, if we get very positive results, we can move those forward to phase three type clinical trials. Now, we're entering a very new era in clinical trial development. And this new era is very much a response to what people call personalized or precision medicine. And the premise behind this is we want to do a much better job developing drugs that have the highest likelihood to help the individual patient based on individual characteristics of tumor tissue, for example. So many, if not most, of our clinical trials now are asking patients for tissue samples and often blood samples where we are working to identify particular biologic or genetic components of the tumor that will help us better develop drugs. By defining these individual characteristics, we can actually develop drugs that target those characteristics with the goal to provide much more efficient clinical trial design, but also sparing patients the chance that the therapy is just not going to help them. The better we can select patients on the basis of their tumor biology, the closer we're going to get to developing more effective therapy. And this is a big change in cancer medicine, where in the past we did not have the technology nor the ability to identify these type of markers. So the technology of medicine, the ability to look at genetic and other biological changes in tumors, it has been enhanced significantly and now fully incorporated in our clinical trials. Now, we do have problems which are of great concern. Currently, only about 3% of all cancer patients participate in these clinical trials, even though these trials are widely available throughout the United States. And this is a concern because when fewer people participate in these trials, it takes much longer to conduct the trials, and it delays finding critical answers. And as I mentioned, with all the new drugs that have been approved, there are actually hundreds of new drugs which we are testing currently. And we are going to need people to actively participate in this work to not only enhance our understanding of tumor biology and individual characteristics, but also to develop even more effective therapies with the goal to prolong life and maintain quality of life. We're also in an era of steep funding cutbacks, particularly within the United States government, and we're all very concerned as to what impact that will have on our ability to conduct this very, very important research. So many of us, and certainly the speakers you'll hear today, are very active in this process and trying to enhance our abilities to conduct this type of research. Finally, I want to talk just briefly about evidence-based medicine. The way we generate evidence in medicine to determine the best approaches for individual patients is through research, including clinical trials. So these clinical trials are important to provide us the evidence which we can then explain to patients in terms of an understanding of what the potential benefits are for individual treatment approaches. And there's clear variation among individual patients, and a statistic doesn't mean much for an individual, but it can help guide people in making treatment decisions. Like, for example, what is the chance a treatment will help me? There is growing emphasis on evidence-based medicine in the United States, and this has led to the creation of guidelines for patient care and treatment pathways, which many, many physicians around the world are now routinely using to help guide patient care. And in fact, some of these guidelines have actually been translated into lay language so that individual patients can have a better understanding of where the evidence is and what is the most optimal treatment approach. We have a number of organizations that work to create these guidelines, including our professional society, the American Society of Clinical Oncology, as well as an alliance of leading cancer centers in the United States known as the National Comprehensive Cancer Network that develops these guidelines that are literally used around the world. And we believe that through the use of guidelines, not only will these guidelines help keep clinicians very up to date as to the latest advances and treatment options for patients, but these guidelines will also help ensure that patients really are receiving the most effective therapies to enhance their treatment outcomes. And with that, I will conclude my remarks and turn this back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Benson. That was really an excellent overview of the research and clinical trials and evidence-based care, and everyone's going to now hear much more about it with the specific types of cancers that they'll be addressing. Our next speaker is Dr. Jeffrey Bruce. Dr. Bruce is Edgar M. Huspian Professor of Neurological Surgery, Vice Chairman, Department of Neurosurgery, Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons, Co-Director, Brain Tumor Center, Director Bartoli, Brain Tumor Research Laboratory. And Dr. Bruce is going to address a brain tumor cancer overview, new treatment options presented at ASCO, and the importance of communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Bruce.
Thank you very much, Dr. Messner. It's always a pleasure to be on this teleconference and talking with all the people in the cancer care community. Let me start by saying this is an exciting time to be in the brain tumor field, as there are continually new advances in the treatment and diagnosis of brain tumors. Just in terms of the basics, you know, brain tumors can consist of primary brain tumors, which are also known as gliomas, which are those tumors that begin in the brain, as compared to metastatic brain tumors, which are tumors that grow in the brain after they have spread from other areas of the body. Now, primary brain tumors can range from low-grade to high-grade, with low-grade being slow-growing tumors and high-grade being fast-growing tumors. The most common high-grade tumor is glioblastoma, which is a type of cancer. And over time, low-grade tumors can progress to become high-grade tumors. High-grade tumors can spread to other parts of the brain or spinal cord, but they rarely spread to other parts of the body. They are invasive tumors in the brain and can potentially be life-threatening. The current standard of care for gliomas is to perform surgery to try and remove as much tumor as possible. Now, because individual tumor cells can actually invade into the brain, it's not possible to completely remove the entire tumor. Additionally, tumors may be in a location that is very dangerous for surgery because of the potential to cause severe problems like paralysis or loss of speech. And in those cases, a simple biopsy may be done to establish the diagnosis of the tumor, although it may not be possible to remove any of it. Now, standard treatment is surgery followed by radiation therapy. Radiation is given daily in small amounts for 30 treatments, so for a total of 30 treatments in small increments. The side effects of radiation can be hair loss, fatigue, or skin irritation, but it is still the most effective treatment known for gliomas. Patients are also given chemotherapy with a drug called temozolomide, which is usually given during the radiation and up to a year afterwards. Although treatment with surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy can be effective, tumors often grow back at some point, and it is at this point where new treatments, often of an experimental nature, are needed, and that's why the studies presented at the recent ASCO conference are so important. There are a number of new and promising upfront treatment regimens for patients with newly diagnosed glioblastomas. There are also a number of studies for patients with recurrent tumors that have grown back after their initial treatment. Now, one of the very promising areas for brain tumors is the field of immunotherapy. And these are treatments that use vaccines and other strategies to help the body's own immune system to eliminate the tumor. Much of the immunotherapy work is still at a very early stage, but the early results are very provocative and promising. At the ASCO meeting, a group from Japan formed a phase one trial of chemotherapy and radiation with a tumor vaccine for newly diagnosed glioblastoma. And these patients also received fractionated radiation and temozolomide followed by the vaccine, and they were able to show some modest improvement in progression-free survival. They also showed that patients that had a complete removal of the tumor benefited more from the vaccine, the idea being that perhaps the tumor is suppressing the immune system in some way. And when you remove the tumor, you're helping to relieve some of the pressure on the immune system, and that makes the vaccine perhaps a little bit more effective. Now, another interesting study from Italy used what is known as dendritic cells or dendritic cell immunotherapy in patients with the first diagnosis of glioblastoma. And these dendritic cells are specialized cells from your body's immune system that have been sort of supercharged to help kill the tumor cells. And this study showed that when radiation was given, it affected some of the other immune cells in the body, and that the reduction in the immune cells resulted in improved survival of patients. So essentially what they're saying is that the radiation actually helped the dendritic cell immunotherapy to work better. Now, finally, another immunotherapy study from the ASCO meeting involved the use of what are called oncolytic viruses. And these are viruses, much like the viruses that cause the common cold, but these are specialized viruses that are engineered to actually kill tumor cells. And a group from Duke University performed a phase one study looking at viruses that were injected directly into the tumor. And these viruses recognized a tumor antigen or a tumor protein called nectin-like molecule 5, which is a protein that is found in malignant cells. And these viruses were designed to bind to that, and once they attached to the tumor cells, they were effective at killing the tumor cells. And so in this clinical trial, although the results are very preliminary, patients seem to do quite well and were exceeding survival expectations. So we're going to need some long-term follow-up on that, but these are at a very early stage, these results are looking very promising. Now, there were a number of studies at ASCO that were looking at new chemotherapies, different types of drugs that could be effective against brain tumors. And there was a few studies that dealt with a type of drug that inhibits topoisomerase. Now, topoisomerase is an important enzyme that cells need to divide and grow. And when you give a drug that blocks topoisomerase, the drug can be very effective, therefore, at killing tumor cells. So in a study from Stanford University, a tirinotecan was used, and this is a type of topoisomerase inhibitor, and it showed that a number of patients with partial responses and other patients that stabilized their disease. So these were patients whose tumors were growing, and when they were given this drug, it either caused the tumor to shrink or at least stopped it from growing in a number of patients. And just as importantly, there was no real toxicity from this. Similarly, there was another group from Japan that used a very similar type of drug called irinotecan, and they used this with Avastin, which is a blood vessel inhibitor. And they showed that patients receiving this drug combination did better than those who received Temodar only. And more importantly, there was no worsening in the quality of life. So these are a couple of provocative drugs in this particular drug class that were very interesting. Now, in patients with tumors that have grown back, that is those recurrent tumors, recurrent glioblastomas that grew back after standard treatment with radiation and Temodar, there are a number of very promising studies that were done. Now, keep in mind, these are patients who've already failed the best treatment possible. And in a multi-center trial, a phase one study was looking at a drug called ABT-414 in combination with temozolomide. Now, ABT-414 is a drug conjugate that actually targets a mutant protein in glioblastomas. So what we mean by that is that glioblastomas, when they grow, they create these abnormal proteins, and this particular drug, ABT-414, was targeting those abnormal proteins. And although the number of patients that responded in this clinical trial was modest, this is an important study because all these patients had previously failed Temodar and were refractory to treatment, so they were in sort of the worst category of patients, yet they had some promising responses. Now, another interesting study looked at a drug called APG-101, and this is a drug that binds to CD95 receptors on glioblastomas. Now, the CD95 receptor is thought to be related to the ability for tumor cells to spread and invade into the brain. Therefore, when you block the CD95 receptor, it seems to block the ability of tumor cells to spread, and that helps to kill these cells. And patients in this study with the APG-101 had an improved progression-free survival. So I want to move on to another group of studies, and this was an area of study involving low-grade gliomas, which are receiving a lot of attention in chemotherapy protocols. Now, a group from Mayo Clinic looked at the long-term results from a study done 10 years ago in patients with low-grade gliomas. And this chemotherapy trial many years ago used a combination of chemotherapy drugs, procarbazine, CCNU, and vincristine, which is also known as the PCV regimen, and along with radiation, and showed that patients did better than patients who received just radiation. So even on the long-term follow-up, this group of patients with low-grade gliomas did better with chemotherapy and radiation rather than radiation alone. And finally, another group from Italy showed that given chemotherapy to patients with low-grade gliomas before they have surgery seems to improve the ability to remove these tumors, particularly from eloquent areas of the brain, such as those areas where that are used for speech. So, and just looking at the ASCO studies, finally, there are a number of laboratories that are looking at molecular markers to predict the outcome or response to treatment. This is something of great interest to brain tumor researchers, and more studies are needed to validate this. But overall, there's great excitement in this field that you may be able to look at certain markers either in the blood and in the tumor itself to predict what kind of treatment would be best for a given patient. So this is an exciting area, and there are more studies than ever, and investigators are getting closer and closer to finding better treatments for this tumor. Now, finally, I want to end by saying a few words about communicating with your healthcare team. First of all, it's important to seek reputable specialists. It's helpful to find people who are specialists specifically in the type of tumor that you have. And with the internet now, it's easier than ever to find these people. Also, by working with support groups and groups like Cancer Care, this can be easily accomplished. They can facilitate this with you. When communicating with your healthcare team, it's important to keep a notebook so that you can write down questions. And that way, when you see your doctor, you can make sure that your questions are answered and make sure that the instructions are understood. It is important to keep an honest dialogue with your family so that they understand what you are going through and can help you make decisions. Also, I would be skeptical of anecdotes, no matter how well-meaning. There are no two patients who are alike, and I would be careful about trying to apply something you have heard about from another patient to your specific case. It may also be useful to have second opinions if time is available. Having other opinions can help refine and formulate your questions. And finally, I would say it is important to consider clinical trials at academic centers. Many of the groups that are presenting at ASCO are the result of serious investigators who have put thoughtful proposals together to come up with new ideas. Working with these groups can lead to more promising treatments for all patients. I just want to end again by saying and emphasizing there are more there's more research than ever being done against cancer and tumors, and this is really a very exciting time to be in the field, and there are a lot of very great new beneficial treatments that are up on the horizon, and hopefully we'll be here soon. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bruce. That was really excellent and really a wonderful presentation on brain cancer, and also in terms of the communication piece with your healthcare team. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Julie Grelo. Dr. Grelo is Professor and Director, Breast Medical Oncology, Jill Bennett Endowed Professorship in Breast Cancer, University of Washington School of Medicine, Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. And Dr. Grelo is going to address an overview of breast cancer and new treatment options presented at ASCO and quality of life issues. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Grelo.
Thanks, Carolyn. I've picked four primary studies that were presented at ASCO 2014 to review. And up front, I'd like to tell those that are listening that I've written these up as well as some other abstracts that you can view online if you go to www.bcsmcommunity.org. The BCSM is Breast Cancer Social Media. So if I talk a little fast, or you don't get all the details and you want to review it, you can go to that website and then look under recent posts on an ASCO update. So let's start with late-breaking abstract one. This was a big presentation that was the combined analysis of what we call the soft and the text trials. These were trials in premenopausal women who had early-stage breast cancer that expressed the estrogen receptor. And the TEXT trial had two arms. It was a big randomized phase 3 trial, as described by Dr. Benson. Everybody in the trial got a drug that shut down the ovaries that was called triptorelin, or they could choose to have their ovaries removed or radiated to shut them down permanently. And then women in the TEXT trial were randomized to receive as their treatment for breast cancer either tamoxifen or an aromatase inhibitor called exemestane, also known as aromacin. So all the women in this study, the TEXT study, got their ovaries shut down at least for 5 years, and that's more commonly done in Europe as a standard where the study was primarily conducted than in the U.S. Now, this was a combined analysis with the SOFT trial. The SOFT trial had three arms, and it used the standard of care in the United States, tamoxifen alone. So that's what a third of the women in this trial got. And then the other two arms, everybody got ovarian suppression, again, with a drug that temporarily shut down the ovaries, and they were randomized to get tamoxifen or exemestane, the aromatase inhibitor. So what we saw was the analysis of the arms where everybody got their ovaries shut down. We did not see the results of the tamoxifen-only arm of the SOFT trial because there haven't been enough breast cancer recurrences to analyze that study in full yet. The reason we were interested in this is because the aromatase inhibitors, including exemestane used in these studies, have shown to be superior to tamoxifen in reducing recurrences in postmenopausal women. But they don't work at all in premenopausal women that have ovarian estrogen production, hence the need to shut down the ovaries in this study. So they combined the results of the arms that had ovarian suppression, and they looked at a primary endpoint, which was essentially disease-free survival. It was the percentage of women who had not had a breast cancer recurrence of any type, metastatic or local or a second breast cancer or a death. So after about 5 years of follow-up, the group that had their ovaries shut down and received the aromatase inhibitor did better in terms of being alive and without a recurrence compared to the tamoxifen group. But overall, women in both arms did quite well. And the percentage of women in the exemestane group who were alive without recurrence was 91%, and it was a few percent less, 87%, if they got tamoxifen. Now, there was no difference between these arms in the number of women who were still alive, so their survival was not impacted by this, at least at 5 years of follow-up. There are side effects from these drugs. The exemestane-treated patients had more osteoporosis, muscle and joint pain, and fractures, and they were more likely to discontinue their drug. 16% of the women in that arm that received the exemestane stopped their oral drug. The tamoxifen arm, there were more blood clots. That's a known side effect of tamoxifen. And only 11% of women, which is still a lot, had discontinued their tamoxifen at the end of 5 years. So the conclusion from the study is that the combination of ovarian suppression with exemestane is an option as the primary endocrine treatment for premenopausal women who have estrogen receptor positive early stage breast cancer. But it doesn't mean that we're sure that it is absolutely the right choice. A prior study from Austria showed the opposite result, So we have questions about why those studies are different. Also, there's no data that says that that combination will help women live longer. And additionally, other studies have recently shown strategies that are better than 5 years of tamoxifen, such as just continuing the tamoxifen for longer or giving some tamoxifen and then some aromatase inhibitors. So we have lots of options, and we're not sure which is best, and it's going to take a careful discussion now. Because we know that ovarian suppression, if that's what's required for this, has lots of long-term consequences on the bone and the heart and our urogenital, our gynecologic health. And we want to be careful about not causing more side effects in this group. We would like them to live a long life, but we also want them to not have problems early with respect to their heart or their bones. So an interesting study, and we have one more possible treatment for premenopausal women with respect to endocrine therapy. So then moving on to late-breaking abstract 505, this was a study called the POMS study, the Prevention of Early Menopause Study. So all young women know that early menopause can be a common side effect of chemotherapy if you're young and you're menstruating, and this can result in hot flashes, night sweats, other menopausal symptoms, as well as infertility and long-term effects on the bones and the heart and the gynecologic tissues, as we just discussed. Sometimes the ovaries recover after chemotherapy and menses resume, but sometimes the effect is permanent. So the POMS study looked at whether temporarily shutting down the ovaries in premenopausal women about to start chemotherapy would lead to less permanent menopause. So could we give a drug, like they did in the study I just talked about, the SOFT and TEXT trial, that temporarily shuts down the ovaries, keep it on board during the chemo so the ovaries are quiet, and then remove it at the end of chemo? Would that result in less women who had permanent menopause? So half the women in this big phase 3 study had an injection of a drug that temporarily shuts down the ovaries called Gocerolin or Zoladex, starting a week before their chemo and continuing monthly through the chemo, and the other half just got chemo. And the study showed that the women who had their ovaries shut down during chemo not only had better ovarian function return, their ovaries came back at 6 months and 2 years. Those were two of the time points that were looked at. But they had improved fertility and more successful pregnancies. So at 2 years, 22% of women in the chemotherapy alone arm had no return of their ovary function, while only 8% in the women who had the Gocerolin or Zoladex with the chemo still had not had their ovarian function return. And then there were 12 successful pregnancies in the chemo alone group and 22 in the Gocerolin and chemotherapy group. So more pregnancies, better fertility. So the study's conclusion was that at least in this group of patients, premenopausal, they were estrogen receptor negative breast cancer patients who were getting chemo, we should be talking about this strategy to help preserve menopausal function and fertility. The third abstract I wanted to discuss is late-breaking abstract 4, called the ALTO trial, which stands for the adjuvant lapatinib and or trastuzumab treatment optimization, ALTO. So this is a trial for patients who have early-stage breast cancer that expresses HER2, which is about 20 to 25% of patients with breast cancer. All the patients underwent surgery, and they all received chemo, and they were randomized to one of four options as to what kind of HER2-targeted drug they were going to get. The standard arm in this big randomized phase 3 trial was trastuzumab, or Herceptin, which continued for a full year and is our current standard of care. One of the experimental arms substituted lapatinib, or Tykerb, an oral HER2-directed agent, for the Herceptin for a year. The third arm used both of these HER2 drugs together, and the fourth arm used the HER2 drugs in sequence, so trastuzumab or Herceptin for 12 weeks, followed by lapatinib or Tykerb to complete a year. So they were looking at better ways of treating HER2-positive cancer. Now, we basically were somewhat surprised to see that the standard of care arm with Herceptin or trastuzumab alone did just as well as any of the other arms. And actually, the arm that got the lapatinib or Tykerb had been closed down early because it did not appear to be as effective as the trastuzumab arm, and we did not see the results of that presented at ASCO. Additionally, given both her two drugs together caused more rash and diarrhea and liver effects, so there would be no reason at this point with these two drugs anyway to give combined HER2 therapy. So despite this being a negative trial, it did reinforce our current standard of care. It did also show us that women with current treatment options for HER2-positive breast cancer are doing very well. It used to be that HER2-positive breast cancer had a very poor survival, and now more than 94% of patients were alive after 4 years of follow-up in this what used to be a very aggressive disease. So we've come a long way. The last abstract I wanted to review was in the metastatic setting, and that was late-breaking abstract 9500, or the OPTIMIZE 2 trial. The OPTIMIZE 2 trial was looking at patients who had breast cancer and bone involvement with that breast cancer or bone metastases, and they were receiving, for the first year, a bone-blocking drug called zoledronic acid. It tries to prevent bone breakdown and bone complications from breast cancer bone metastases. So these patients had been receiving monthly zoledronic acid or Zometa, and then at the end of about a year of monthly treatment, they were enrolled in the study, and they were asked to be randomized to continue receiving monthly treatment or to switch to every 3 monthly treatment. There were 403 patients between the two arms, and what they showed after a couple of years of follow-up was that the percentage of bone complications due to the bone metastases was similar between the two groups. It was 22% of women that continued to get the Zometa monthly had a bone event, meaning a fracture, spinal cord compression or needed radiation or surgery to the bone, and 23% in the every 3 month group, and that was not statistically different. So there was no difference in the bone events, and so a conclusion of this study is that women who have received about a year of monthly zoledronic acid that can safely switch to an every 3 month dosing schedule without having an increase in bone events. Additionally, we looked at side effects and showed that although a complication called osteonecrosis of the jaw, which is kind of non-healing bone in the jaw, it's a rare side effect of Zometa, and it was seen in 2 patients who kept getting the Zometa monthly, and it was seen in no patients when they switched to every 3 months. So by switching to less frequent zoledronic acid, these women's quality of life was improved because there were less complications with respect to this rare but serious side effect of osteonecrosis of the jaw. And, of course, maximizing quality of life both in the metastatic setting as well as in early stage breast cancer and survivorship is a key, that we should be focused on in our breast cancer studies. So with that, I would again tell you that if you want to look at a summary, you can go to www.bcsmcommunity.org, and in that I've also listed about 9 different abstracts in the metastatic setting of not ready for prime time, but some promising new types of therapies for metastatic breast cancer that were presented in very early form, but just to show you that there's a lot going on there. So thanks very much for your time.
And thank you, Dr. Grillo. And would you repeat again that the website that you're giving to everybody? Would you repeat it twice just to be sure everybody has it? Because I know everyone wants to go to that website.
So it's www.bcsmcommunity. So it stands for Breast Cancer Social Media Community.org.
Perfect. Thank you so much. That was a wonderful presentation and lots of information. And so thank you very much. That was wonderful. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Carolyn Runowitz. Dr. Runowitz is Executive Associate Dean for Academic Affairs, Professor, Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Florida International University, Herbert Wertheim College of Medicine. And Dr. Runowitz is going to present on ovarian cancer, new treatment options presented at ASCO. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Runowitz.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and thank you and your organization for putting this on. It is such an important conference for our patients. And I have to say, I love listening to the other colleagues. I always learn something. So I'd like to, in the next 13 minutes or so, give you an overview of ovarian cancer and then discuss the exciting new treatments or combination of new treatments that were presented at ASCO, and to also discuss precision personalized therapies in ovarian cancer, which was also a big part of the meeting. So as an overview, most patients present with stage 3 or 4 ovarian cancer, although we may be thinking of this more as starting in the fallopian tube, and obviously that will have implications for prevention and screening, which was not covered at this meeting, but which is another exciting avenue of investigation. These patients undergo cytoreductive, or what we call debulking surgery, and it should be done by a GYN oncologist who sees patients with ovarian cancer. There's no question that survival of the patients is dependent on experienced surgeons who have the volume. This is usually followed by chemotherapy, which is given either intraperitoneally or intravenously, and in most cases now will be followed with some sort of consolidation therapy, and right now the most promising is bevacizumab, which has been discussed earlier on this call. Most patients, however, will develop recurrent disease, and that's really, I think, what the ASCO 2014 meeting focused on. There are many active therapies currently available, but at ASCO's meeting, there were many exciting new therapies or combination of therapies. So I hope in the next 13 minutes that we can get through them. There was a late-breaking abstract, and as you heard from Dr. Grelo, these are exciting new submissions that get presented or get submitted later than the standard abstracts and will be put on to a large plenary session. And we had one in ovarian cancer by Liu and her group. And this was interesting because it was a combination of treatments and not chemotherapy. It was a PARP inhibitor, and it was olaparib, and the anti-angiogenic agent, sidarinib, versus the PARP, olaparib alone, in platinum-sensitive high-grade disease. What was also interesting are these are both oral agents. So this is, again, a change. No chemotherapy, no intravenous. So this is really kind of exciting. And both BRCA patients and non-BRCA patients and patients who had been treated with prior anti-angiogenic therapy, for example, bevacizumab, were stratified. And it showed that the combination was very effective with twice the number of months for progression-free survival, and the treatments were well tolerated with a little more toxicity as expected in the combination. So I think that we can look forward to larger studies, confirmatory data, but this is clearly on the horizon and will be both active agents and quality of life for our patients. Ursa Matalunas' group presented through the regular abstract submission process a phase 1 PI3K inhibitor in combination with olaparib. So there were a lot of studies that were looking at the combination with the PARP inhibitors, and specifically olaparib. This study included patients with high-grade ovarian serous cancers. It was a small study, 34 patients with ovarian cancer. The majority had germline BRCA mutations. Responses were seen at all dose levels. So again, this is a combination non-chemotherapy, very similar to the Liu data, and they determined the dose of the phase 2 trial, and that will be starting shortly. Pignata and their group discussed the MITO-11 trial, which is platinum-resistant patients or refractory disease. So this has been a particularly challenging group of patients, and they used pazopanib, an oral multikinase inhibitor of the angiogenesis platelet-derived growth factor and c-KIT, in combination with weekly paclitaxel, and again showed an improvement in progression-free survival and overall survival, such that they're recommending a phase 3 trial. So that group of abstracts showed that you could use these new inhibitors with or without chemotherapy, and again, the use of oral agents. Other novel therapies were also presented. Lurbinectin blocks transcription and induces double-strand breaks versus topotecan and in platinum-resistant and refractory disease, and this was deemed active and recommended to go on to a phase 3 trial. So, again, another new drug. The Hamanishi from Japan, the Kyoto group, looked at the anti-PD-1 antibody for programmed cell death in platinum-resistant patients. It was a small study but had promising results and suggested a dose response rate. So we can begin to anticipate more studies showing the anti-PD-1 antibody, and this particular study had promising results. There have been some studies that have yet to show activity in ovarian cancer patients, but this one did. De Leon presented phase 1 liposomal doxorubicin in combination with nintedanib, which is in platinum-resistant ovarian cancer patients, found it to be tolerable and is expanding that phase 1 trial to a phase 2 trial. Krasner's group looked at CRLX101, which is a novel cyclodextrin-containing polymer conjugate of camptothecin, a drug that we do use in ovarian cancer. It inhibits HIF-1-2, which is an inducible hypoxia factor, and demonstrates synergy with bevacizumab, and they show that this is an active agent in phase 2 trials, and so we'll continue to explore that drug. There was a phase 2 of a study of what we call SMAC, which is a mitochondrial-derived activator of caspases in ovarian cancer, platinum-resistant group of patients. And this is a very promising new therapy for inhibiting pro-survival NFKB signaling. So we saw some, in this particular group of abstracts, we saw a lot of new agents with activity, so certainly a great pipeline. And the last one in that group was defactinib, which targets stem cells. And this is the first time that we've seen activity of stem cells in combination with paclitaxel. It was a phase 1-1B study, again an oral molecule, which inhibits FAK and showed activity. So we believe in ovarian cancer and other cancers that the refractory stem cells may be an issue. So this is in the pipeline and is very promising. Then there were a group of abstracts that looked at trabectedin in combination with chemotherapy. Colombo's group looked at the drug in combination with Doxil prior to retreatment with platinum and platinum responders. And what we find is in patients who are platinum responders that we treat them for a while, they go into remission, and then they will recur. And what she and her group did was use this as a way of extending the platinum-free interval and resulted, when they were subsequently retreated with platinum, in an increasing response rate to the rechallenge with platinum. So, again, a very novel agent used in a very novel and innovative fashion. The Japanese group looked at temsirolimus, an mTOR inhibitor, and the same drug, this trabectedin, small study, and what they reported was significant stable disease. And although the patients really want to have a response better than stable disease, in my experience with ovarian cancer, we've turned it into a chronic disease, and my patients and others are finding that they can live a long life, a good quality of life, with stable disease. And so ovarian cancer has become a chronic disease. And then lastly in this group, using this drug, which is a minor groove DNA binding agent, in a BRCA or BRCAness population with platinum sensitive found it was very active in patients with prior platinum responses. So this gives us, again, confirmation that this is an active drug in patients with ovarian cancer. And then as we heard from the other groups, immunotherapy was a big player in this year's meeting. And so in ovarian cancer, Gray's group from Seattle looked at immunotherapy using the MUC1 dendritic cell vaccine, which we heard a little bit about before, in patients in remission following second-line chemotherapy, and their results were very promising, and they recommended a larger consolidation trial. And finally, getting away from treatment specifically to prediction and precision personalized medicine, there were many abstracts looking at the molecular classification predictor of response in choosing the agent. So there were molecular subgroups identified. What we've determined from the TCGA data and from other studies is that ovarian cancer, like breast cancer, like many other cancers, is not one disease. We have to think about it as at least four diseases for patients with high-grade serous type. And the four types are differentiated, immunoreactive, proliferative, and mesenchymal. And based on the certain subtype, they may have different responses. So Gurley's group looked at the immune molecular subtype and noted that they had superior survival compared to the other subtypes that I just mentioned. However, in this particular subgroup, they did not see a response to bevacizumab or Avastin. And actually, that bevacizumab and Avastin in this group may result in a reduction in progression-free survival. So the subtype may become very important in the future in predicting treatment. Boris's group reported a very similar finding of bevacizumab and the subtype predicting response. And then Friedlander's group identified drugs targeting mTOR, one of the pathways, or c-MET, may have therapeutic potential in certain patient subsets. And then lastly, there was a group, Oliver's group, and presenting data from in collaboration with a company that looks at molecular subtypes. They looked at platinum and taxane sensitivity. They used predictive biomarker profile to identify active treatment in initial specimens, and they were able to predict which patients would respond to the platinum taxane, which is standard therapy, versus the non-responders, and they concluded that this might end up selecting patients who would not respond to standard therapy and at that point going to some of the alternative therapies that we discussed. So overall, I came away from the meeting with an excitement, knowing that we have a great pipeline, knowing that we have currently active drugs and how to use them better. So I thank you for listening, and I thank again Cancer Care for putting on this very informative conference call. And I'd like to thank Dr. Messner for all that she does with Cancer Care.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Dr. Ronowitz. It's an excellent presentation, and I really want to really thank you for your presentation. And our next speaker is Dr. Susan Slovin. Dr. Slovin is attending physician, genitourinary oncology service, Sidney Kimmel Center for Prostate and Urologic Diseases, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, professor of medicine, Department of Medicine, Weill College of Cornell University. And Dr. Slovin is going to provide an overview of prostate cancer and new treatment options presented at ASCO, and quality of life issues as well. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Slovin.
Thank you, Carolyn, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. As you've heard from all my colleagues in the variety of different malignancies, this has been a great year for developmental treatments for a wide variety of diseases. As many of you can recall from some of my prior sessions with Cancer Care, prostate cancer has been very fortunate that within the last two and a half years, we've had no less than five new therapies, ranging from the first FDA-approved immunotherapy known as Cipollucil C or Provenj to an established second-line chemotherapy for patients who have failed docetaxel. The name of the chemotherapy is cabazitaxel. Two new molecules, or new drugs, actually, that focus in on the heart of the development of prostate cancer, the androgen receptor. And that includes the two oral agents, enzalutamide and abiraterone. There's also been another breakthrough in pain management using radium-223. This is the same drug that, believe it or not, Mary Curie had discovered at the turn of the 1900s, but it is now being used intravenously in patients, given monthly for about 6 months, that can control pain with very, very favorable outcome. So the one common thread for all of these treatments is that it's been for patients who have failed conventional hormonal therapies and or chemotherapy, what we call castration-resistant or castrate-metastatic. And we often do not focus on probably an unmet need population, and that's the patients who come in brand new, newly diagnosed, who have metastatic disease for whom the standard of care still remains hormonal therapy. Perhaps the biggest breakthrough we've had in prostate cancer at the current meeting was the fact that adding chemotherapy with a standard agent, which has been docetaxel, the standard of care in prostate cancer, that when you give this to conventional hormonal therapy for patients who have metastatic disease, again, at diagnosis, not after anything else, but brand new, there seemed to be a very significant benefit, not only in quality of life, but other measurements that we use to indicate that the treatment is very successful. So this was a very large trial, close to 1,000 people. It was 790 patients to be exact, and they were broken down into two groups. All of these patients presented with metastatic disease, but what was very interesting, the disease could be in bone or soft tissue, but they broke them down into patients who had high volume versus low volume disease, and the high volume patients were those patients who had greater than 4 metastatic areas in their body versus those who had fewer. And what they found was significant benefit to those patients who had greater than 4 metastatic lesions. And the benefit was such that there appeared to be a very significant difference between those who had the greater number of lesions versus those who didn't. Now, why is that important? Well, first of all, this is the very first time that we've been able to justify and validate in a phase 3 trial the use of chemotherapy very, very early on in the disease. And what's also very exciting, and what we've had updates on during the meeting as well, is that many of the other novel androgen receptor-directed therapies, such as enzalutamide or abiraterone, not only have they been approved in the post-chemotherapy setting, which was where their niche has been, but now they are moving up even earlier to the pre-chemotherapy setting. So now for somebody who has brand new metastatic disease at diagnosis, we have a lot more alternatives. Certainly if a patient chooses not to go on to chemotherapy but goes on to hormones but may have a very limited response, we do have these other androgen receptor-directed therapies available to them a lot earlier, meaning that the time for some patients to chemotherapy may be longer. Now, chemotherapy is not for everybody, and as I've mentioned during prior discussions, my own rationale for using chemotherapy in patients who have failed hormonal therapy has been if someone's PSA was skyrocketing, doubling or tripling in less than 6 months, or if they were symptomatic, not eating, just failing to thrive, or if they had such significant metastatic disease that I would have to radiate multiple sites and jeopardize their bone marrow. Chemotherapy spares the marrow, improves quality of life, and overall will make people do a lot better in many cases. Now, we have other drugs to do that now. We have the radium-223, as I just mentioned. But perhaps what's very exciting about everything here is now we can actually use chemotherapy for those patients who present with metastatic disease along with hormonal therapy. There is one caveat, as we like to say, And that is, there are patients for whom giving this combination may be more than what they need. So one can best image this by thinking that having four little areas in the bone, which are so very tiny that may not even be an issue for the patient, giving this combination of docetaxel with hormone, standard hormonal therapy, may not be of any benefit, or it may be just, as what we'd like to say, just overdone. On the other hand, there are people who have very significant tumor burdens at diagnosis with multiple sites of disease in bone for whom this would be ideal. And then there are these peculiar presentations where there may be one very, very large area involving the hip or the sacrum that it looks like four or more that have all sort of coalesced together, and that might be another reason. So again, one would have to take this under advisement with one's doctor. One size does not fit all, which is one of the benefits of our current strategies, is because we are able to try to custom fit a lot of the therapies to the patients. So it has been really a delight to know that we can now do this. Now, what else is new? Well, you heard one of our other colleagues talk about personalized medicine, and what we are learning over time is how to really target our efforts on those pathways that tell the prostate cancer to grow. And it, as I said earlier, it's driven by the androgen receptor. The androgen receptor can change, which leads to resistance. And a lot of discussions have ensued trying to define how we deal with these resistant cells. What are the mechanisms that cause it? How do we try to adjust our thinking to make newer therapies? And one of the interesting presentations had to deal with the androgen receptor itself. That's the driving gene, if you will, behind the development of the cancer. And it's stimulated by testosterone, which we usually treat with hormone or testosterone ablative therapy. And this has to do with what we call androgen receptor splice variants, which has to deal with the actual physical appearance of the gene. It changes in such a way that it can render patients who have been doing relatively well on either enzalutamide or abiraterone subsequently resistant to these treatments. So there was a lot of information looking at patients who had failed both abiraterone and or enzalutamide, and this has not led to any breakthroughs in terms of what the next best treatment would be, but it has certainly facilitated our understanding of how we might go forward in the future with even better drugs than we have now. And believe me, they're darn good. But the best thing is to realize that there's a tremendous concerted effort looking at patient specimens, bone marrow biopsies, lymph node biopsies that are generously provided by our patients so that we can follow them over the course of their disease as their disease transitions from localized to metastatic to resistant, and in some cases those that fail the newer androgen receptor modulated drugs. So I'm going to stop here because I think a lot of patients should be aware that the ASCO, the American Society for Clinical Oncology, ASCO, does have a website. It is very user-friendly to non-physicians, where one could peruse the abstracts. I would say that it's very difficult to hear all these presentations and absorb everything, but the presentations, I can assure you, is probably looked at either online or in person by at least 98% of practicing oncologists. So if further detail is needed, by all means, after you look at the ASCO website, do print something out. Take it to your medical oncologist or radiation oncologist or even your urologist, and the meeting is attended by all of these people, and discuss it. And I think you will be derive significant benefit in understanding that all of us are learning together. So on that note, I will return this to you, Carolyn. Thank you.
Well, Dr. Sullivan, before you leave the call, I just want to say that this has been wonderful, but would you say a little bit about this, doctor, a little more about the communication piece, because I think people are hearing new information, and the question is how do they discuss that with their healthcare team?
That's an excellent point, Carolyn. Thank you. There is no question that there's a plethora of information out there, and it's very hard for patients to try to figure out what is right for them. This is why people go to doctors, and they come in, people do come in, and they are overwhelmed with the information. They are completely uncertain how they should be proceeding. One of our other colleagues just mentioned, I believe before me, that one size does not fit all, and nor does one treatment fit every patient. There are wonderful resources out there from the American Society of Clinical Oncology, the American Cancer Society, Cancer Care, where you can listen to different presentations, you can read various presentations, and get a sense of what's going on. But that doesn't mean it translates to easy understanding. Even at my level, it's hard to gather the information very rapidly and process it. My own recommendation to my patients, who I'm sure are listening, and others, would be to, there are newspaper articles on the web that will give you, updates on what the new treatments are. Print them, bring them with you to your doctor, and I'm sure the doctor will be very amenable in discussing it with you. I've already had, when we talked about the chemotherapy, I've had about five people in a row come in with newspaper clippings saying, what was this for me and how does it apply? And it gives people perspective. It has given people tremendous encouragement knowing that we are really, as physicians, working so hard to try to get a better understanding of the disease and to make patients aware that they're not alone, that we still continue to try. And the armamentarium that we have now is so much greater than it was 5 years ago, let alone even a year ago, that most of the diseases that you've heard about today are truly, truly chronic diseases. I hope that answered the question, Carolyn.
Excellent, as always. Thank you so much, Dr. Slovin. That was really
superb.
Thank you so much. And thank you. And our next presenter is Dr. Andrew Wagner. Dr. Wagner is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Department of Medicine, Harvard Medical School, Active Medical Staff, Adult Oncology, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. And Dr. Wagner is going to present on sarcoma, new treatment options presented at ASCO, and the role of targeted therapy. It's my great pleasure now to introduce to you Dr. Wagner.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. It's a true pleasure to be involved in this call and to speak to all of you on the phone. I just in listening to these last several talks, it just reminds me how amazing each ASCO is and the breadth of discoveries that are presented each year. And it's really an exciting meeting to attend, and lots of patients attend. And I encourage you to attend in the future if you want to hear these in more, the presentations in more detail. I'm going to talk about sarcomas and the presentations that were quite exciting at ASCO this year about sarcomas. And many of you may not have heard about sarcomas, and that's because they're quite rare. It's actually a collection of diseases. They constitute probably about 50 different diagnoses that we lump together in this one title of sarcomas. They together make up about 15,000 cases per year in the United States, and just for comparison, for lung cancer, there are probably more than 300,000 cases a year. So these are rare diseases, but still, for every patient that has it, it's incredibly important. And we focus on the management of patients with these diseases, but increasingly, it's also on the biology of the tumors, because this has provided us great insight into how to treat them. And those insights have actually extended from sarcomas into how we treat more common diseases like lung cancer. These tumors can arise anywhere in the body, in the back of the belly, in the extremities, in the head and neck area, in the chest. And some are very indolent, which means that they grow slowly and tend not to spread, whereas others can be quite aggressive with rapid growth in the original site or a significant chance of spreading, metastasizing to other parts of the body. Like most cancers, we treat the local disease with surgery and sometimes with radiation therapy as well to try to remove the tumor completely from its original location. And in some cases, we add chemotherapy to reduce the chance that it spreads to other parts of the body. And for tumors that have already spread, most of those we will treat with chemotherapy to try to control the tumors and stop them from growing. And as we just heard from the last speaker, more and more this is turning into long-term disease control. And more as a chronic treatment of a long-standing disease like diabetes rather than the more abrupt care that has been the case for many cancers in the past. The treatments that we use for this can include standard chemotherapy drugs, just like we use for other types of cancers, or increasingly with things that we consider targeted agents. And you've heard about quite a few targeted agents from the other speakers, and I'll talk about some of those in sarcoma in a few minutes. Our development of drugs in sarcomas often are pooled into groups of sarcomas. Because of the rarity of them, it makes it very difficult for us to study an individual tumor type, and we often lump them together. Sometimes that works very well because we can quickly see a large distribution of tumor types and get a sense for whether a drug works or not for that patient population.
But sometimes it also makes our analysis more difficult because we are sometimes comparing apples and oranges in terms of whether a drug is working or not. Other types of studies are focused on very specific subtypes of sarcoma, and I'll mention some of those in a few minutes as well. The benefit of those types of studies is that we can ask a very specific question, does this drug work in this disease? The downside is that we don't have a lot of patients with those diseases. It requires worldwide collaboration, and fortunately we have many expert centers throughout the world who do participate in these studies, and we can relatively quickly get patients onto these studies, but they may be numbers of 30, 40, 50, few hundred patients, whereas in diseases such as breast cancer or prostate cancer, there can be thousands of patients in those studies. So those are some of the challenges that we face when we do these studies in sarcoma. But again, I think the nature of collaboration among sarcoma investigators and physicians throughout the world really makes this an exciting place to work, and major advances have happened over the last several years. So one of the studies that was quite exciting at ASCO this year was presented by Dr. Chawla from California, and he presented a study that was comparing a standard treatment for sarcomas called doxorubicin to a newer drug called aldoxorubicin. It's doxorubicin with an A-L in front of it. Now, doxorubicin has been around for many years. It's also called adriamycin, and it's used for sarcomas. It's also used for many other tumors like breast cancer and lymphomas and other disease types. It's a standard first-line treatment for sarcoma, and it can work quite well, but the use of it is often limited by one of its side effects, which is that at high cumulative doses, it risks damaging the heart. So even if it's working, we often will stop using it after about six cycles or about 4 or 5 months of treatment because of our concern that if we continue to use the medicine, we will permanently damage a patient's heart. And this has been known for many years and has limited its ongoing use. So aldoxorubicin is the same drug. It's still doxorubicin, but attached to it is a linker, a chemical linker, which is given, when the medicine is given to a patient, it binds to a protein in the blood called albumin. And this is tightly bound to the protein. It travels throughout the blood system into all the tissues, but it gets released. That linker gets cleaved off in environments that are very acidic. And it turns out that many tumors are very acidic, whereas the rest of the body is not. So the idea behind this type of drug is that it's the same drug as doxorubicin, but it's being specifically delivered to areas that are acidic, and those are commonly tumor areas. In earlier studies, it was found that this did not seem to have much damage to the heart or did not affect the heart at all compared to what doxorubicin was known to do. So in this study, they took patients who were newly diagnosed with sarcoma, and they were given their first line of therapy was with this medicine, and they were randomly assigned to either receive aldoxorubicin or doxorubicin. And just for comparison, the dose that they got of aldoxorubicin was almost four times the dose of doxorubicin. Again, we couldn't give that kind of dose of doxorubicin because of the concerns of damaging the heart, but there did not seem to be any issues related to cardiac toxicity in the study with the aldoxorubicin. And the outcome of the study was it looked like the aldoxorubicin was doing even better than doxorubicin does in controlling the disease in these patients and in shrinking the disease in these patients. There was a little bit more in terms of side effects, such as low blood counts or irritation of the lining of the mouth, but really importantly, there was no increase in damage to the heart. In fact, there was almost none detected. So this was a really exciting drug that seems to be even better than our standard treatment for this. And the company that's developing this drug is moving ahead to try to develop a strategy to do the type of study that would lead to getting it approved by the FDA for treatment for our patients. This is still an investigational drug, meaning that we can't just prescribe it. The only way to get it is to participate in a research study. And that type of study is now actually opening and accruing patients. So more to come, hopefully, on this drug, and hopefully we'll continue to see that benefit in the study that will lead to get it, hopefully will lead to get it approved. Another study that was presented did not actually show benefit of a new drug or a drug in combination with a standard drug, but I think this is a really important study as well. As we heard from the first speaker about the design of clinical trials, is that we do want these to show that we have a newer and better way of treating patients who have advanced diseases. But we also want to know if the drugs that we think will be helpful are not being helpful. Because if by doing that kind of study, we can find out whether it's better not to give that drug, either because of side effects to the patient, inconvenience to the patient because of the number of visits they have to have, or truly, as is becoming more the case in our healthcare environment, the cost to the patient or to the healthcare system or to insurance, which if we're giving drugs that are not useful, we shouldn't be using those drugs. So Dr. Pinnell from France did a study in a very specific subtype of sarcoma called angiosarcoma. Now, these are tumors that can develop often in the skin, but also in other places in the body. And they have they develop almost into blood vessels, the blood vessel tumors that can spread to other parts of the body. That's the angio part. Now, one of our standard treatments for this is a drug called paclitaxel, or Taxol. And this is a drug that's commonly used in many different tumor types, including ovarian cancer and lung cancer and other diseases as well. And we often use this for angiosarcoma, and it can work very well. One of the theories was because of the blood vessel nature of these tumors, that a blood vessel-directed therapy may, in combination with the chemotherapy, may improve the ability to shrink or control these tumors. And the drug that they combined with paclitaxel was called bevacizumab, or Avastin, and you've heard about this before as well. It's a commonly used drug in many other tumor types as well because of its ability to attack blood vessels in tumors. So the question was whether these vascular tumors are also dependent on signaling through this pathway that bevacizumab or Avastin can block. So the patients either receive paclitaxel alone, or they received paclitaxel in combination with bevacizumab. And both groups did well. Both groups had good shrinkage of their tumors, did well in the therapy for a significant period of time, but there did not appear to be any benefit to the combination of the two compared to the single drug. And again, this is very helpful for us to help us recommend therapies to patients, because based on these data, we would not recommend the combination of this expensive and potentially toxic drug, bevacizumab, to the standard therapy, paclitaxel. So again, even when we have studies that are disappointing in their outcome, they can be very informative and help us guide our future therapies. Now, the bevacizumab is an example of a targeted therapy. And targeted therapies, as we've heard from other speakers, are increasingly being developed for many different tumor types. So instead of lumping all sarcomas together, for example, we can look at individual tumor types, find out what are the mutations or the proteins that drive that tumor to grow, and then develop specific drugs that go after those abnormalities in the tumor cell and ideally not affecting normal cells at all. And that's a way to get very good at disease control or very good treatment of the disease without causing a lot of toxicity. And the most classic example of this in solid tumors is a sarcoma called gastrointestinal stromal tumor, or GIST, or GIST. And this now for about 15 years has been the poster child for how we develop targeted therapies in solid tumors. Most GIST are driven by a mutation in a protein called KIT, K-I-T. And when KIT is mutated, it's constantly telling that cell to grow and divide, and it leads to uncontrolled growth of the cells that leads to a tumor. And about 15 years ago, a drug called Gleevec, or imatinib, was being developed for treatment of leukemia, but we also recognized that it could affect KIT and stop KIT from working. And it's been proven to be a really effective therapy for treatment of GIST. It's really a wonderful story, and it's really remarkably changed the way we treat this disease. Now, unfortunately, although Gleevec works for many, many patients for a long period of time, a lot of patients do later on have growth of the disease, and now we have two other drugs that are also approved for the treatment of GIST, and those are sunitinib and regorafenib. But even with those being effective drugs and being shown to be effective in the setting of prior resistance, we still need more therapies for this disease. And Dr. Heinrich from Oregon described an ongoing study of a drug called ponatinib in patients with GIST that's been previously treated with these other drugs. Now, ponatinib is also approved for this leukemia because it inhibits this other protein in leukemia called ABL, but it was also known to have activity against KIT. So Dr. Heinrich and his colleagues have been studying the role of ponatinib in patients with GIST, and it's early still to make big conclusions about the efficacy of the drug, but the initial results were really promising, that it looked like a significant proportion of these patients who've been through at least two or three other lines of therapy for their disease were once again getting disease control once they went on this drug. So more to come with this drug as they continue to study it, but we're very excited about the initial findings. Major side effects have been some irritation of the liver, elevation in blood pressure, as we see with other drugs of this class. But so far, we're very excited in this pathway. And then lastly, I just wanted to talk about extraordinary activity in another disease for which a few years ago some investigators were able to find what we think to be the driver in the growth of this disease. The disease is called pigmented villonodular synovitis. In sarcoma, we have all these very unusual, strange, and difficult to pronounce names, but PVNS is the abbreviation that we use for it. And a protein called CSF1 was found to be expressed at high levels in many of these tumors. These actually are not malignant tumors. They don't spread to other parts of the body. But instead, they occur in a joint space, and they can destroy that joint space and cause a lot of pain and disability to patients, often young patients, patients in their 20s, 30s, and 40s. And what happens when CSF1 is produced in these large amounts is that it draws in all these inflammatory cells because it's like a homing signal for these cells. It usually helps to fight infection, but instead it's drawing these inflammatory cells into the joint space, and instead they're attacking the bone and the cartilage and causing a mass to form. It's very painful for patients. So two different studies were presented looking at inhibitors of that protein and the protein signaling pathway. One was by Dr. Tapp from New York, and one was from Dr. Cassier from France. They used the drugs that they described were two different types of drugs. One was a small molecule, a pill, that inhibits the enzyme, and the other was an antibody that can inhibit the enzyme. But they both showed very similar results, which was striking activity in the vast majority of patients in terms of shrinking their tumor and improving their symptoms. And this was an earliest stage of design. So this was the initial patients being treated with these drugs. And both of these drugs now are going to be explored in larger studies to try to prove to the level of evidence needed by the FDA to get its approval. But again, identifying the mutation in a tumor type can lead us to find specific drugs or develop specific drugs that attack the tumor by itself with less toxicity in normal cells. So this was an exciting year in sarcoma, but also in many different tumor types at ASCO in general. And I think you've heard from all the other speakers about the wide range of active studies that are going on. And as I mentioned, some of them provide disappointing results, but we still learn quite a bit from these studies, and they really help us guide the therapies. I think it's important, as some of the prior speakers have mentioned, for you to know about these studies and to read about them either on the ASCO website or in newspapers or magazine articles or on other websites, but also to bring these studies to your providers and discuss them with them. They hopefully will have heard about them and understand the studies, but if they haven't heard about them, I'm sure they would appreciate the information as well and be able to help you interpret those studies, because sometimes, as you well know, the jargon and how we report these things can be quite confusing or difficult to understand. But again, a very exciting year at ASCO, some really remarkable studies, and every year I come back even more energized about the findings that from this year and what to expect or what may be coming in the next year. So I thank you very much for your attention, and I hope I provide you a nice overview of the world of sarcoma.
Thank you very much, Dr. Wagner. That was really excellent, and just an excellent summary. And Dr. Wagner is our last presenter today on this program, and also his wonderful reminder to everyone about really all of the new research that is going on continuously in the cancer field. I do want to remind everyone that this is a one-hour education workshop, and that in planning this program that we do recognize that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. So I do want to remind all of you that we have a lot of social workers here at Cancer Care, and that they are here to provide a host of services to you, from individual support and counseling to support groups, both on the telephone and online. And we also offer practical and financial assistance as well. We also have a number of publications, and indeed this entire two-part series will be turned into a booklet, Highlights from ASCO, and it will be available in a few months, and you will all receive a copy of that booklet. It'll be really a summary of many of the presentations that you heard today and all of the information that I know that you've been trying to absorb so carefully, and you'll be discussing with your physicians as well. We also have a very robust website, and there's lots of information there, and we offer many of these workshops, so I invite you to participate in many of our upcoming workshops as well. Most importantly, as we conclude our program today, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with cancer. I do want you to know that you're part of this cancer care community of support, and we're here to help you. And that means that you can call us anytime at 1-800-813-HOPE, and that our social workers are here to answer your questions, provide support to you and services, and all of this is free, and it's really just a telephone call away, or you can visit our website at www.cancercare.org, and you can actually post questions and ask questions, and our staff will get back to you as well. So again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes today's workshop. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.